It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after this latest world news headlines.
Multiple explosions in northern Nigeria take at least 21 lives. Kenyan authorities arrest hundreds and search for bombing suspects. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Multiple explosions near an oil depot in the Nigerian city Maiduguri killed at least 15 civilians and 6 suicide bombers. Officials said soldiers blew up 3 vehicles laden with explosives. A 4th car exploded, apparently set off by a suicide bomber. A surviving attacker was arrested. The police commissioner of Nigeria's Borno state said the attack appeared to be the work of Islamist militant group Boko Haram, the group blamed for thousands of deaths since 2009. Police in Kenya's capital arrested hundreds of people Tuesday following explosions Monday that killed at least 6 people. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
For more than 3 hours, police carried out door-to-door searches of nearby residential buildings, looking for sympathizers of Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. Police demanded everyone produce identification cards and search people's rooms. Most of those arrested were Somali refugees who are required to have alien cards issued by the Kenyan government. Kenyan officials have ordered Somali refugees living in urban areas to return to designated camps, following a wave of terror attacks and threats in the country attributed to Al-Shabaab. The country's security officials have warned there will be more arrests until those behind Monday's attack are found. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Kenya's Interior Cabinet Secretary called the bombings barbaric. There's been no claim of responsibility for Monday's attacks, which wounded more than 24. The International Criminal Court has postponed the trial of Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, this time until October 7. He's charged with helping organize deadly violence following Kenya's disputed 2007 presidential election. The court said the delay is to give Kenya's government more time to provide records sought by ICC prosecutors. Those prosecutors said they lack sufficient evidence to go ahead with the trial and allege that witnesses have been bribed or pressured not to cooperate. Human Rights Watch's Richard Dicker says the burden of proof must be certain in the case involving a head of state.
The prosecutor has alleged that a number of her witnesses have either been intimidated or disappeared under pressure exerted supposedly by those close to President Kenyatta. I think another lesson to learn is if one is charging a senior official or indeed a president, it's imperative to bring a case that is as airtight as possible.
Mr. Kenyatta denies the charges against him. His deputy, William Ruto, is currently on trial at the International Criminal Court on similar charges. Saudi Arabia announced Tuesday it's suspending issuing visas to Muslim pilgrims from Guinea and Liberia, two countries hit by an outbreak of the deadly Ebola virus, the Saudi Health Ministry calling it a preventive measure. The outbreak, which began last month in southeast Guinea, killed nearly 80 with more than 120 suspected cases. The World Health Organization is seeking to downplay the seriousness of the outbreak, noting far worse situations occurred earlier in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Uganda. Here's reporter Lisa Schlein.
WHO spokesman Gregory Hartle says there have been larger outbreaks of Ebola recorded in Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. He says the outbreak in Guinea is relatively small compared to the one in Uganda in 2000 and 2001, which infected more than 400 people. 4 cases of the disease have been reported in the Guinean capital, Conakry, but Hartle says it is not unusual to have cases in capital cities.
In Gabon, in the 1990s, I believe there were cases in Libreville. The source of infection is still quite localized in the southeast of Guinea.
Ebola is spread through blood and other bodily fluids from an infected person. It can also be transmitted by the handling of contaminated corpses. Bats and primates are the original source of the infection. Hartle says it is essential to stop the chains of transmission. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
World Bank President Jim Yong Kim Tuesday said Africans have been denied electricity, and that amounts to what he calls global energy apartheid. Mr. Kim says more than 1 billion people worldwide are without electricity, many of them in Asia or in Africa. He unveiled the bank's $73 million grant to the Democratic Republic of Congo for developing a 4,800-megawatt hydroelectric project. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. More can be found at our internet website, voanews.com.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A European Union-Africa summit opens today in Brussels, despite calls to boycott.
There's been, of course, positions which have been taken, which is very healthy in these kind of situations. But as far as we know, most of the African countries are very keen to participate in the event.
Aldo de la Ricia is the European Union ambassador to Zimbabwe. Doctors Without Borders calls for stepped-up emergency assistance to South Sudan before the rainy season begins in fall. Muslims remain trapped in the Central African Republic town of Boda, and a Muslim cleric accused of supporting Al-Shabaab has been assassinated in the Kenya city of Mombasa.
I take him as another Islamic cleric who supports Islam and tries to make the religion a better thing, not like pushing people to join Al-Shabaab or all that.
Ali Juma is a Muslim and a local resident of Mombasa. Ghana police increased public protection after a number of unresolved murders. And Rwanda marks 20 years this year since the 1994 genocide. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The European Union-Africa Summit opens today, Wednesday, in Brussels after African leaders refused to heed calls by some countries like Zimbabwe to boycott or push for a postponement over allegations that the EU was dictating the composition of African delegates. Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe called for a boycott of the meeting after his wife, Grace, was refused a visa to attend. Mrs. Mugabe is on the EU's travel ban. EU Ambassador to Zimbabwe, Aldo de la Ricia, says more than 40 African heads of state had accepted invitations to attend.
The summit is taking place that we are expecting 40 heads of state and heads of government of the 48 African countries to participate, and 22 heads of state and heads of government from the side of the 28 member states of the European Union.
But is it not being overshadowed, Ambassador, by some of the countries that are saying they are not happy by the manner in which African countries were invited?
I think there's been much more rumors than actual problems. For instance, when there's been these recommendations by the Committee of the Permanent Representative in the African Union that were united under the format of Political and Security Committee, they made a recommendation. And this recommendation was interpreted as a resolution, but it was just a recommendation, a non-binding one. And most of the heads of state and heads of government were not aware. They didn't mandate this committee to make this recommendation. So we are asking the different cabinets of the heads of state and heads of government, and none of them was aware of any possibility of postponement or even less cancellation of the event. So I think that there has been a kind of manipulation of the situation. There have been, of course, positions which have been taken, which is very healthy in these kind of situations. But as far as we know, most of the African countries are very keen to participate in the event.
European Union Ambassador to Zimbabwe Aldo de la Ricia was speaking with Chris Gandhi of VOA's Zimbabwe program. A Muslim cleric accused by the United States and the United Nations of supporting the Al-Qaeda-linked Somali militant group Al-Shabaab was assassinated late Tuesday in the Kenyan port city of Mombasa. His lawyer said Abu Bakar Sharif Ahmed was shot dead along with another unidentified man near the Shimo Latewa prison in Mombasa. Ali Juma, a Muslim and local resident of Mombasa, says the late cleric Sharif Ahmed was not an Al-Shabaab supporter. Instead, Juma tells me Sharif Ahmed was just another Islamic cleric who tried to make Islam a better religion.
Surely it's very sad what is going around, because it's not the first time a cleric to be killed in the same way which happened today around late evening.
You said this is not the first time. Why do you think people are targeting the clerics?
They say that most of the clerics deal with the Al-Shabaab and all that.
And what do you think? Do you think the cleric Abu Bakar Sharif Ahmed was an Al-Shabaab supporter?
Not really. I take him as another Islamic cleric who supports Islam and tries to make the religion a better thing, not like pushing people to join Al-Shabaab or all that.
When you say that this is not the first time people are targeting Muslim clerics, who do you think is targeting the Muslim clerics?
It's not clear. Also, the media doesn't even say, like, what happened the first time, second time, to different clerics. Also, this one, till now, it says it's an unknown assassination which went ahead around Shanzu in Mombasa.
The late cleric is on record of supporting Osama bin Laden. Do you think that's why people might have targeted him?
That's what I also said to the past two clerics which passed away. It was the same thing. And now this is the same story which came up about the late Sheikh Abu Bakr Sharif Makaburi.
We hear that there was some rioting after the assassination of the cleric. And what happened?
Yeah, there are bits of riots around the Majengo area and Bondeni. But then the police were sent to these areas to calm down people and to stop the riots.
How do you think the cleric was assassinated? Was he in an open place, in a car, or was he in his house?
I was not at the scene already, the way it happened, but what I heard on the media, he was in a car.
You said that he was not Al-Shabaab supporter. He was just trying to be a true Muslim. What do you mean by that?
His summons, you know, at least you'll know about the summons and everything, or his ways of life. And as far as I know him, or heard his speeches and summons, it's not like he was supporting them.
Tell us again, what is the situation now in Mombasa?
Now tension is everywhere. Everyone is, like, afraid to be outside because the riots and everything. Apart from the police being around, the tension is still high. People are afraid any time the riots might pop up.
Ali Juma is a Muslim and local resident of the Kenyan port city of Mombasa. He was speaking with me from Mombasa. The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders is urging humanitarian agencies to speed up emergency assistance to South Sudan before the rainy season gets fully underway and roads become flooded and impassable. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Doctors Without Borders Director General Bruno Jochem has returned from a visit to South Sudan. He says aid agencies are racing against time to pre-position stocks of relief supplies before the rains come. He worries they may be losing the race. He blames much of this problem on rigid bureaucracies in the United Nations, various governments and donors' organizations. He says these systems are excessively slow in assessing needs and dispersing funds, and that it takes most organizations 3 to 5 months to get the money they are promised. Jochem says aid agencies need the money now while they still have access to people in need. Fortunately, he says, there are no political obstacles to dispersing aid in South Sudan because government and opposition forces are giving aid groups free access to all areas. But he says the security situation puts many areas out of reach.
You have probably close to 1 million people who are missing the planting season, who have left with their belongings, and who will not be able to harvest in a few months from now. So they will be very dependent, not only food assistance, but relief in general. Yeah, it's quite critical for both stocks, logistics, and emergency programs to be put in place to respond to this challenge in a few months down the line.
Doctors Without Borders runs a large operation in South Sudan. It has 340 international staff and 20 projects, 8 of which have started since fighting broke out between the government and rebels in mid-December. During his recent visit to South Sudan, Jochem says he saw that several of his organization's structures had been severely looted or damaged or nearly destroyed. In some cases, he says, field teams had to be evacuated. Despite these circumstances, Jochem says his organization is continuing to provide critical health services for thousands of victims of this war. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's Wednesday morning, the second day of April, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. The time on Daybreak Africa is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. members of parliament in Ghana have asked the police to increase protection for legislators and the population after expressing concern about the recent surge in unresolved murders in the country, especially in the capital, Accra. The police say their criminal investigation division has launched an inquiry into the killings. Some Ghanaians, however, say they are worried since the police have yet to arrest anyone behind the murders. CFAS author, Director of Public Affairs of Ghana's police, tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the Ghanaians are not used to the recent surge in murders.
So the police are doing a lot about this situation. Already, it is because the police are firmly on the ground and embarking on patrol day and night, then mobile and foot. Community and highway, that the crime situation in Ghana is at the barest minimum. The issue of killing that you have recorded is quite a recent development. The police have intensified patrol. We have intensified all our operational strategies to nip it in the bud even before it becomes a problem. I can say that what has happened is not anything alarming. It is just because Ghanaians are not used to this in recent times.
Some people say that there are some unresolved murders, especially in the capital, Accra, and they wonder if the police CID or the Criminal Investigations Division is on top of this to find the perpetrators of these crimes and bring them to book.
Sure, the police are on top. The CID is on top of the investigation. Except that you and I know that matters of serious crimes like murders, armed robbery and others sometimes take time to resolve them. But then I can assure you that every effort is being made to get to the bottom of these. I know for the first couple of such murders that we have recorded, some people are in court facing charges for having had any hand in them. In as much as it is worrisome, and as much as the police is concerned about a few incidents that have happened, we haven't reached the stage where people should throw up their arms in the air in despair. Comparatively, we have a safer country, but then we are not going to sit down on concern and let this situation degenerate.
How is the police engaging the Ghanaian population to reassure them about their safety following these concerns that they have raised?
I hope you may have heard about some police officers going on air to reassure Ghanaians that it has not reached any alarming proportion yet and that every effort is being made to nip it in the bud. A typical example, I can say that even physical actions have been taken to assure Ghanaians. Only last Saturday, there were some sweep operations in some cities, including Tema, where we recorded the latest incident of killing. And some people were rounded up, and they are being investigated. Police and other cities have taken up the challenge, and they are doing everything possible to bring the situation under control.
CFAS Arthur is Director of Public Affairs of the Ghana National Police. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Accra. In Western Central African Republic, entire towns have been emptied of Muslims. Some have been killed, while thousands of others have fled the anti-Balika militia who attacked them earlier this year as Muslim Seleka rebels withdrew to the northeast. In the southwestern town of Boda, thousands of Muslims are trapped as international troops struggle to keep a lid on tensions. Viewers and Look has this report from Boda.
There is an invisible wall now dividing the town of Boda. This Muslim man was shot when he ventured across it 2 days ago. On one side is the town's Muslim population. On the other is the Christian population, including the mostly Christian anti-Balika militia. Each side says the other started the fighting. It began January 29th, after the Muslim Seleka rebels left town. Dialogue has failed. Violence only eased when French troops established this border. They call it the Red Line, only it's not really a line, it's a circle, surrounded by anti-Balika. Boda's mayor, Mohamed Awal, a Muslim, draws a map.
This goes to Bangui. We can't cross this bridge, and we can't go here. We stay only in this district.
Hunger is the top concern. Muslims can't get to the market. They say the anti-Balaka won't let Christian merchants come and sell food to them.
No medicine, no security. The anti-Balaka, they are killing. There is no food. Every day is to the cemetery. Every day we need fabric to wrap bodies.
Clashes continue in the bush. Muslims have been fleeing into town. This man says he walked 40 kilometers after being the sole survivor of an anti-Balaka attack that killed 20 people, including his two wives and five children. African Union peacekeepers from the Republic of Congo deployed to Boda at the end of March. Their commander, Captain Gislain Singu, calls a meeting on the Christian side. He says his orders are to keep the peace.
Those who hurt the population, I will hunt them even if they go into the bush. I have the men and the equipment for that.
The chief of the anti-Balaka in Boda, Dopani Firmin, has a simple message. The Muslims must go, he says. That is the only solution. Locals get up to talk. They thank the anti-Balaka, and they repeat, the Muslims must go. Back in the Muslim neighborhood, some see economic reasons for this surge of resentment. Muslims control much of the commerce in Boda, including the gold and diamond trade. Some worry their homes and businesses will be destroyed if they leave. Still, many say they'd go if they could. Anne Look, VOA News, Boda, CAR.
As Rwanda marks 20 years since the 1994 genocide, a group of visitors from a U.S. Holocaust memorial are touring sites around the country, drawing connections between two of the worst atrocities in the 20th century. VOA's Gabe Jaslow reports on the significance of memorials for confronting the pain of the past.
A wooden shelf stacked floor to ceiling with skulls and bones fills the back wall of the Interama Church Memorial outside Kigali. It was here, a tour guide explains, that some 5,000 people were killed during the genocide of 1994. Coffins of some of the dead lie on the pews. The victims' ragged clothing hangs from strings tied to the ceiling. Angelique Mukapukizi was one of the few survivors of the attack here. A young mother at the time, she only survived because the killers who thought they were executing her did not realize after they finished hacking at her body that she was still alive. Now, bearing scars on her neck and arms, she tells her harrowing story to this group of visitors from the United States. As difficult as her experience has been, she feels it is crucial to tell the world what happened in this place. If someone comes to visit the memorial and asks me for the testimony, she says, I do it confidently. It is like showing him the history of Rwanda. We cannot hide it, and if he understands it, it can be a good lesson for him and the rest of the world. The group visiting this day knows full well the importance of learning lessons from the past. It is part of a delegation from the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. Michael Abramovitz, the director of the museum's Center for the Prevention of Genocide, says one of the main functions of memorial sites is to ensure that history is not forgotten.
And we really want to focus part of our efforts at the museum on raising awareness, raising consciousness about the fact that genocide did not end after the Holocaust, sadly, and that we still have a long way to go in realizing our collective vision of never again.
Touring these memorial sites in Rwanda, he says, is a different experience from visiting a museum.
First of all, we are only 20 years after the genocide in Rwanda, and we're about 75 years after the Holocaust. And so what happened here is raw, and obviously there is no substitute for actually being on the place where these crimes happened. That's a very powerful thing.
There are numerous sites across Rwanda, like the Interahamwe Church, where the real bodies of victims are left on display, and the walls still bear bullet holes describing unspeakable violence. Powerful reminders to the living of the not-so-distant past. Ildefonso Karengera, director of Memory and Prevention of Genocide at Rwanda's Anti-Genocide Commission, says these emotional memorial sites give victims a space to confront the past and to find some comfort.
It takes them back to the period in which they were living during genocide, But at the same time, also, it is a relief for them because they can cry, they can express themselves, they can, say, they give testimonies of what happened.
Rwanda officially begins commemoration of the genocide on April 7th in Kigali, when President Paul Kagame lights a national flame of mourning with a torch that has been touring across the country since the beginning of the year. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Kigali.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. In an all-Malian affair, AS Real played Joliba in the group stage of the Orange Africa Confederations Cup, according to the Confederation of African Football draws conducted in Cairo, Egypt, on Tuesday. Congo-Brazzaville's AC Leopards face Ghana's Medeama. Tunisian clubs Etoile du Sahel and Bizertin play Guinea's Horoya and Zambia's Nkana, respectively. Elsewhere, Egypt's El Ahly engage Morocco's Difa Hassani Jadida. Ivory Coast's Sewe Sports and ASEC Mimosa encounter Nigeria's Bayelsa United and South Africa's Kaizer Chiefs, respectively, while Cameroon's Cotton Sport engage Angola's Atletico. Turning to wrestling, hosts Tunisia and Nigeria emerged winners of the men's and women's contest at the Africa Senior Wrestling Championships staged at the El Menza Stadium in the Tunisian capital, Tunis. Tunisia retained the men's Greco-Roman event title, amassing 73 points. Morocco had 58, Egypt 55, Algeria 45, Chad 26, Congo-Brazzaville 22, Sierra Leone 8, and South Africa 7 points. Tunisia also won the men's freestyle division with 67 points. Egypt had 53, Nigeria 51, Algeria 50, while Senegal and Morocco tied in fifth place with 38 points each. Cameroon amassed 35 points, South Africa 27, Chad 21, Guinea-Bissau 18, Congo-Brazzaville 12, Namibia 11, Madagascar 9, and Mauritius 4 points. Staying in Tunis, a significantly improved Nigerian team edged defending champions Tunisia in the women's wrestling event when they amassed 67 points. Tunisia scored 61 points, Cameroon 53, Senegal 44, Chad 26, Egypt 18, South Africa 17, Sierra Leone 9, Guinea-Bissau 8, while Congo-Brazzaville and Ivory Coast shared the 10th spot with 6 points apiece. Overall, Tunisia topped the medal table in the 16-nation contest with 7 gold, 5 silver and 5 bronze medals. Egypt placed second ahead of Nigeria. Algeria is fourth, followed by Senegal, Cameroon, Guinea-Bissau, Morocco, South Africa, Sierra Leone, Madagascar, Congo-Brazzaville and Namibia in that order. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a great day. Our listener mail for this Wednesday morning comes from Mohamed Ahmed Mansour of Monrovia, Liberia. He says, "Dear VOA, I think it's about time for the Kenyan government to do more to protect the lives of its citizens. The indiscriminate killing of innocent civilians is barbaric and is totally unacceptable and unjustifiable. The Kenyan government should get rid of all Al-Shabaab elements if they are to be free from these attacks." We thank you, Mohamed Ahmed Mansour of Monrovia, Liberia, for your comment. And please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Multiple explosions near an oil depot in the Nigerian city of Maiduguri have killed at least 15 civilians and 6 suicide bombers. Nigerian officials say soldiers blew up 3 vehicles laden with explosives, while a 4th car exploded, apparently set off by a suicide bomber. That's it for this Wednesday, April 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Love African music?
Music Time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.
From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition.